Our world has become complex and disruptive, and leading teams and organizations takes courage, determination, and skill. This podcast connects you to some of the great leaders to find out just how they do it. You're listening to Russell Boyce and Daryl Crook in conversation with standout leadership in a world of disruption.
Welcome, listeners. Welcome, everybody, to our next edition of this podcast, Leadership in a Disruptive World. Daryl and I are very, very privileged today to be having a conversation with Dr. Keoki Jackson. I've known Keoki for quite some time now. Keoki is one of these guys who is an outstanding figure in the world of deep technology globally. The particular way that he has implemented that in terms of a career progression, starting with a PhD at MIT, working for quite a while at one of the biggest aerospace primes in the world, Lockheed Martin, and making it all the way to vice president of that company, and now senior vice president at the MITRE Corporation, which is an example of a very interesting beast in the US, and I'm sure Keoki will probably describe that for us. Keoki is also, he's an influencer of people, and I think often in ways that he doesn't realize, but for the good. So I've known Keoki for quite a while and had a great satisfaction and pleasure in every interaction that I've had with him. Keoki, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Russ, it's always great to be with you.
Excellent.
Keoki, a very big welcome from me as well. And I did have the pleasure of meeting you in at a STEM conference a year or so ago that Russell and I were speaking at here in Australia. It's great to see you again. Keoki, I wonder if you might just start for our listeners. And our listeners, Keoki, are global, of course. And they range from young 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds who are in the very early stages of learning about leadership, all the way through to board chairs around the world who really are interested in refining and taking on some of the more contemporary issues. Of course, there are many senior executives listening in today as well, and they're keen to listen to some of your views and some of your insights and some of your learnings around leadership. So perhaps for our listeners, Keoki, just, you know, give us a little bit of the Keoki Jackson story. I know Russell has touched on some of it, but tell us what it was that led you to where you are today.
You bet, Daryl. And again, it's wonderful to have the opportunity for this conversation. You can think of me as maybe a deep technologist who ended up in the defense industry and some of the largest defense challenges that we faced over the last 20 years or so. And I started off as a spacecraft engineer, but rapidly found that I was particularly interested in working on problems that were bigger than any individual engineer or set of engineers could solve, and really got going on working in some large space programs, primarily focused around national security, communications, global positioning systems, missile warning, and things like that. And that was what led me ultimately, you mentioned that I ended up as CTO at Lockheed Martin. And there I had the wonderful opportunity to work across a whole set of technologies that drove really that entire spectrum across the business. So think about aeronautical systems to spacecraft, to communication systems, electronic warfare, and a whole realm of things that connect all of those different kinds of platforms and capabilities together. And that ultimately, again, in sort of my progression in leadership and the ability to have impact on large-scale national security problems, that ultimately led me to where I am now at the MITRE Corporation. As Russ noted, it's a little bit of a different kind of an entity. I think in Australia, there's nothing quite like it. But MITRE is a nonprofit. Interestingly for me, somebody who spent the better part of my working career in for-profit companies and for-profit businesses, but a nonprofit that does a few billion dollars worth of work every year, primarily in the service of the federal government of the United States. And so I focus on the national security world, where I lead the national security sector here, all of the work for the U.S. Department of Defense, work for our allies and partners, including Australia in the defense sphere, and also work for our intelligence community. But MITRE, just to set the background, we also operate federally funded research and development centers beyond national security, in the realms of homeland security, transportation, health, cybersecurity, and areas like treasury and commerce. So what excites me, and I, again, this theme of being able to tackle really big and challenging problems, is I can work across different parts of the government now because of that breadth of scope and scale that MITRE brings across the different parts of the U.S. federal government, so that we're able to apply real whole of nation solutions. And I'll pause there.
Yoki, there's a lot in your experience. We could take this conversation in a million different directions right now. I'm going to take it in the following direction. You've just mentioned what MITRE does in doing not-for-profit work to meet the needs of a whole variety of different government customers. And in the process of that, you would be interacting with the for-profit sector and also the research community. And the for-profit sector probably includes large companies and small companies. That's a very, very complex melting pot. And your work would be very, very important as part of a value chain. Each large program of or body of work would have a value chain associated with it, where every, you know, the different government customers, MITRE Corporation, like-minded organizations, the different industry players, research players, they're all part of that chain. They all have to pull together to achieve that enormous outcome that's needed. Getting those different parts of the chain onto the same page is a challenge. That's a leadership challenge. They don't know how to talk to each other. They often don't know what language each other speak in from an organizational culture background. Can you tell us your experience of that? How do you tackle that challenge? How do you get those disparate folks onto the same page so that you get an outcome that's good and not bad?
Well, that's a complicated question or set of questions there, Russ. And I guess I'll start with this idea of integration as a leadership challenge. And so you noted the complexity of the ecosystem, the value chains, what it takes to actually get a very diverse set of stakeholders on the same page. And so maybe I'll just give a little bit of that landscape. If you think about just the national security domain in the U.S., where you have a Department of Defense that spends over $800 billion annually on a whole realm of different activities across the spectrum of acquisition to operations to personnel and pretty much everything in between. But that's delivered by an enormous industrial base. That industrial base is not just specific to the defense industry, but reaches across into all kinds of different technology sectors. And increasingly, in a lot of areas that impact on things like data, artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, heavily software driven versus the planes and ships and aircraft and tanks that you might think of. But it also rests on a technology ecosystem. And so if you look at the companies I've worked for, we have deep engagements with academic institutions for many reasons. Obviously, we require the ability to recruit top technical talent from these, and all the work that we do relies on high technology. But importantly, having the research partnerships. And so I'll just, you know, I have the opportunity to work with incredible institutions from MIT and Stanford to the top universities in Australia, University of New South Wales, University of Melbourne, and I could go down the list. And so if you abstract back and say, you know, how do we get people to work together on these complex problems? I'd say, you know, the first thing that we always start from, and this has been true in all of the different kinds of businesses that I've worked on, start from the mission challenge. So really establishing clarity around the mission. And so in the defense business, you know, we're very focused today on the problem of deterrence, and particularly of deterring increasingly aggressive Chinese Communist Party. And obviously there is a hot war going on in Europe, so deterring further aggression by Russia in particular. So if you were to take that now, how do you break that down into the elements of deterrence? What are the systems that you need and so on? And ultimately being able to, I think in sort of a systems engineering perspective, how do you understand that in terms of a set of requirements? And these will be capability requirements, but ultimately they need to be turned into business requirements, talent requirements, all of the things that you need to assemble that picture. But getting agreement at the top level on what is the problem that we're trying to solve, I think is often the challenge of any leader at any level, from a frontline leader to your most senior executive. And ultimately that becomes the basis of strategy as well. I think, you know, there's a lot of complexity to developing strategy, but for any kind of an organization, really getting clarity on what is the problem or the set of specific problems that we're trying to solve is really important. For a company like I'm in today, it is really driving at what are the hardest challenges that reside at that intersection of our domain, in this case, national defense or national security, technology and systems integration, and then being able to pinpoint what specifically do we need to work on most, and then use that to drive a set of capabilities. And then you hit on the communications element, right? And I think the ability to get a diverse set of people on the same page, one is really understanding what are the win-win elements for a variety of organizations that goes from educational institutions to government to for-profit industry to organizations and NGOs like our, non-governmental organizations like ourselves. And so that, I think, leads to one of the ultimate challenges for a leader is to be able to communicate clearly and crisply what are the specific challenges, what are the needs that you have from all of the stakeholders, what is it going to take, and what do you not have? And often those are some of the hardest discussions, because that's what prompts those conversations about where are we really, where do we need to be, and then what are the choices that we need to make, strategy being all about making choices. What are the choices that we need to get from here to there?
So that's a complex answer to a complex question. Thank you. I want to zoom in on what that looks like for you, the person, in those conversations with the other leaders, the leaders of those other organizations. When you get into a room together, you've identified what the mission challenge is, and you're starting to grapple with who thinks what of which aspect of it. How do you as the person engage in that moment with those other leaders and bring them on board, or you know, if clearly somebody's on the wrong path, how do you correct that personal what the NCA business school would call the 5-foot self-aware, people-aware capability?
Well, as you know, engineers aren't necessarily the most self-aware folks in the world, but you've hit on something. A lot of times in the work that we do, you know, We want it to be very data driven, and for there to be an exact right answer or an optimum answer. Again, starting from what is the problem that you want to solve, that often leads to the recognition that there are a lot of different ways to get there. And so then, you know, a lot of the and this is where doing the homework up front really makes a difference. So being able, when you get those folks in the room, to be clear, what are the specific elements or measures of success? If I'm going to build a communication satellite, who do I need to talk to? When? At what bandwidths? With what probability of availability? With what reliability of the system? And so on. So what are the elements that really matter? And getting clear agreement on that. And then understanding what the constraints are, and a lot of and being honest about those constraints. What is your real budget? What is the what are the resources that you have availability? What is the talent? What is the what are the time constraints? What are your shareholder expectations? What are your cash flow expectations? And so again, getting clarity on the boundaries that you're operating in. I think. I mean, I know that once you've done those, and I don't want to oversimplify what it takes to get there, that dramatically reduces the decision space that you have to operate in. And it also allows you to have honest conversations about whether a particular course of action actually gets you to those objectives within the constraints that you're working towards or working with.
Piotr, you've touched on a number of issues there that have kind of got me smiling a little bit. You know, you talked about starting with that mission. We were speaking with a previous guest recently on one of these podcasts who almost word for word said the same thing. He said, you know, we've got to get that clarity of, and he used the word purpose, whether it's mission or whether it's, we've got to be very clear about our purpose. And he said, the more I work in that senior executive space, the more I understand getting that clarity, getting that agreement and understanding of that common purpose, that common mission, if you will. And he also went on to say, getting that alignment both vertically and laterally across the organization of all of the moving parts, and trying to drive some of that interdependence, whether it's within one organization or, in your case, across a number of organizations, there's a common theme there. Kiaki, I found myself smiling. You said you had an engineering background, and then you made a comment about engineers there, and I'm sure we've got many engineers listening in. I also spend most of my life with engineers, either in the mining industry or the construction industry or at universities. So I hear you. There's a conversation going on. I'm interested in your views of this conversation. There's a conversation going on at the moment, Kiaki, with and let's, you know, without necessarily just isolating engineers, I think anybody across those STEM subjects, of that realization along that journey of developing whether we call it people skills or communication skills, or whether we broaden it out and say developing and strengthening the emotional intelligence, which kind of ties into that old line of kind of what got you here won't get you there. Can you comment for our listeners on that transition that you made from that engineering technical only, let's call it, focus, to that broader strategic culture people focus that leadership requires?
That is a great question. That's really the second half of what I started there. So I gave you an answer that really only dealt with the first half of the problem. I'd say some of those quantifiable business outcomes or business measures. But the reality is, in everything we do, it is people. At least for now, it is people that make all of this happen. It is people that do the systems engineering. It's people that come up with the innovative technical solutions. It's people who figure out how to solve problems that haven't been solved before. And You hit on a couple of things. One is particularly for these complex mission challenges where you might be talking about, you know, tens or hundreds of different systems coming together. They all have to be synchronized in time and space. And there are very, very demanding outcomes, right? You know, we think about timing in picoseconds or accuracies in very small distances and so on. Ultimately, you have to figure out how the people are going to make that happen. And so let me maybe touch a little bit on the, you know, the up and down is often easier, right? There's more of a direct command and control. But I have found over my career that the most valuable often are the across relationships. And that certainly is true when you're in an engineering organization and, you know, you may be in one particular discipline, but, you know, if you're the thermal subsystem, you're dependent on everything else that goes on that particular platform, like a satellite. And if you're a systems engineer, then you have to orchestrate all of that stuff. But ultimately, as you move up to senior leader and senior executive roles, I think the earlier people figure this out, the better, because I've certainly seen, even at some fairly senior levels, people struggle with this, that your job is not to be great at everything. Your job is to make sure that everything comes together to have a great outcome. And that means, you know, you need great human resources folks that are going to help you, you know, develop a talent strategy and build a team and design benefits packages and understand what it takes to retain and grow your staff. You need a great communications team. I mean, a lot of what we've talked about today is how we communicate. That means internal and external communications team. None of us who survive in business can get there without having a great financial and business operations team. You can't continue to grow a business strategically without a good strategy and business development organization. And that doesn't mean that you should be great in any or all of these things, but certainly recognizing when to step back and pull these other folks in. And what I found too is these can't be a series of one-on-one transactions. And I'm sure there are many ways to organize. I know that it seems like in some organizations we've tried them all, often right after one after the other. But finding those ways where you can bring that full set of stakeholders together and get them again focused on those specific mission challenges. And everybody's going to have their own perspective. Everybody's going to have their own organizational imperatives, but keeping people focused on the mission outcomes, that's one of the best things that you can do as a leader.
Yoki, you just described the leader's requirement to have some fluency across the different skill sets that are required to not necessarily be for him or herself to be expert at any particular one or all of them, but to know where to go to find them to ensure that they are available. I'm thinking, and you mentioned that you used the word breadth, I think, or something like that. Let's talk now in a similar sense, but in a vertical sense, and not in terms of hierarchy within an organization, mm-hmm. where one person reports to another person and so on. But if you remember, maybe 10 minutes ago, I mentioned the INSEAD Business School and their description of the 5-foot level of self-awareness. Well, that's actually a subset of their concept of the altitudes of leadership. And again, this isn't hierarchy in an organization. They describe the 50,000 feet level of strategic thinking capability, the ability to conceive of that mission challenge, to understand how to go after that and to bring their people with them. The 50-foot level, that's the tactical operational. That's where the engineers feel the most comfortable. And then the 5-foot level is that personal, self-aware, team-building, cultural element. the leader needs to be able to fluently and seamlessly move from one altitude to the other. And if not, they have what can be described as altitude sickness. What's your experience in the roles that you've had and the organizations you've played in with that, the need for being able to move up and down in those altitudes?
Yeah, well, you and I have talked about these altitudes of leadership before. And we haven't talked about altitude sickness. My observation is if the leader has altitude sickness, and that leader may not know it, probably the organization is going to have altitude sickness as well. Being a strategic leader, strategic decisions, and these would be consequential things, bet the company kinds of things, sometimes they come out of nowhere and they happen in the moment, and they don't have the opportunity for long time frames. And so, a great example would be that 3 years ago, we effectively shut down in-person work for a long period of time with a global pandemic that nobody had really prepared for. So, to your point, you have to be fluent in maneuvering through these different levels. I would look at it maybe in the sense that as leaders, all of us need to be growing. If you think about these as levels, as not just levels, but also as dimensions, right? And over my career, over my journey, and to the point of the discussion that we just had, I was an engineer who thought I could do other people's, if I'm a great engineer, I'm not saying I'm a great engineer, but if I'm a great engineer, I can probably be a great HR person or a great communicator or a great finance person. And breaking that mental model is really important. But that doesn't mean that I shouldn't aspire to grow in these different dimensions, whether it's, and again, to your point, at the interpersonal level, I will tell you honestly, I mean, I suffer many of the transactional, I'd say, engineering characteristics, right? And I've learned that you cannot succeed, at least not to the level that I aspire to, without putting a lot more emphasis around the interpersonal elements, getting to know the people that work for me, getting to know even better the people that I work with, understanding their constraints, understanding what they care about, and then understanding, and this is probably most important, what they need, even if they are not willing or able to articulate it themselves. And so that is, that might be a 5 foot level thing, but it enables you to do some of the things at the 50,000 foot level. And so that's just one example. And, if there's one element of leadership enlightenment, do you remember the movie Glengarry Glen Ross? And they talked about, it's a movie about real estate. That's really a movie about people, not necessarily about leadership. But one of the mantras was always be closing, right? ABC, 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 yeah. Always be closing. I think, what I aspire to is always be growing. And so that would be the ABG. And quite frankly, although I still love the deep technical work and would love to be able to keep up with more fields than I do, my main focus is how do I become a more effective communicator today? How do I become a more effective growth agent and change agent, the ability to lead change? These are the things that have become most important to me over time.
Jackie, thank you. Your openness, your honesty, your humility is on show there, and I applaud that. And I'm sure listeners around the world would be just hearing this as gold, particularly from someone who has taken the journey that you've taken. In a minute or two, Russell's going to want to start to really come in on, you know, what are those disruptive elements in your world that you are trying to lead your way through. But just before we go to that, I just want to round out this conversation around the issue of emotional intelligence and people skills and growing. One of the things that we're noticing, Keoki, across many organizations is a drift away from hierarchies, and it's not a slow drift in many organizations. It's quite a quick drift away from hierarchies toward either a matrix style of organization or more openly a sort of more of a networked style of businesses, interdependent businesses, interdependent parts, more networking styles from an organizational structure point of view. What this translates to for many leaders, for many people, for many professionals, is the ability to influence without authority. Now, for yourself, working in a not-for-profit, bringing a lot of moving parts together, I'm sure you are also experiencing the need to influence without authority, without that direct, because I said so, I'm your boss, authority. I'm interested in you just taking a moment to touch on that. What are the skills needed, the additional skills, let's call it, needed to be able to influence without authority?
Yeah, I would call that one of my continuing growth areas, first of all. And you know, if you think about the kind of business that I've been in for my career, a lot of these grew up as sort of command and control businesses, hierarchical, relatively top down. You are absolutely right. Things have changed quite a bit and quite rapidly. And we find to get after the kinds of problems, take, for example, if you want to do integrated command and control of a whole bunch of joint cross-military or even cross-country kinds of systems, I mean, you need to be able to rapidly assemble the best people from a whole bunch of different fields. And because a lot of this stuff operates essentially at the pace of software, you got to be organized to move at that pace as well. So this idea of, you know, it's been talked about as teams of teams, but the ability to rapidly assemble and disassemble, really important. A couple of things. One is understanding what you can and can't do, right? Because that helps to understand what are the elements of the team that you're trying to build. The second, what I found is you cannot do this in a command and control way. And you know, this is sometimes hard for me to admit, but you've got to empower the folks who are closest to the teams, closest to the problems, and allow them to go and self-assemble. But then it gets to, you know, the idea of how do you manage in that kind of environment to actually get those mission outcomes, those purpose-driven outcomes. I think that now, if you think about what a leader has to be, a senior leader has to be able to do, you have to be able to understand where are the links broken, right, in that network. You have to be able to understand whether you have the right, I'll use it in terms of the redundancy of nodes, right? You know, do you have people that can back each other up in different skill sets? Do you have appropriate measures and metrics to be able to see if the outcome is really heading in the way it's supposed to be? And that's a lot more complicated than in sort of a linear engineering process. And ultimately then establishing the environment, and this is really an environment of trust to be able to make all that work together, because now people have to receive and give and be able to depend on others in a much more fluid way than you might in a command and control kind of an environment. So those are just a few observations.
Keoki, you mentioned the word environment and you talked about environment of trust, but you were also implicitly referring to the broader environment that you create within your organization and within the groups of organizations that come together, that environment of not just trust, but you know, the team pulling together, understanding each other, understanding where the skills are, et cetera, et cetera. And that environment can be challenged. It can be sometimes fragile, particularly in the face of disruption. And this podcast is about disruption, the disruptions that are more and more powerful. They're coming faster and faster in this world that we live in. So let's talk about disruption, what that means for you. In your world, what's looming at the horizon or just beyond the horizon that could represent a disruptive threat to what you personally are trying to achieve and what your organization is trying to achieve? What can sneak up, perhaps spill over from other sectors, other areas that worries you? And how are you dealing with that?
Absolutely. Well, let me first maybe just start with the geopolitical disruption. And so we're facing, you know, an environment where 10 years ago, we probably were not too concerned or just starting to become aware of a complete change in Chinese capability and Chinese behavior in the national security space. And that intention to really become a leader and dominate in certain areas, whether militarily, economically, technologically. Certainly, we didn't expect a couple of years ago or a few years ago that there would be a significant war in Europe, a war of aggression. So, I mean, those are some of the realities. And you add on top of that continued terrorist threats, rogue states like North Korea. It's a pretty dynamic environment. So those are the kinds of things that that certainly get our people worried, particularly in the kinds of missions we deal about. I'd also say there's a new sense of urgency, and it's driven by a couple of things. One is the sense that these aggressors or these threats are moving very fast, and we need to be ready and we need to be prepared. And that means ensuring that we create certain capabilities as rapidly as possible, and that we can prove that they are usable and can be deployed and operated. But then, I mean, honestly, we struggle with all the things that you would struggle with in any business, constrained resources, right? And when you don't know what your U.S. government budget is likely to be, and I think we've all seen some of the budget brinksmanship that's been happening, that's a pretty dynamic environment to be in. Talent. Maybe I'll start with what's driving some of our talent questions. Rapid technological change. If you look at the things that are really changing the world of national defense, yes, it is things like, you know, higher performance aircraft or hypersonic vehicles or stealth technologies. But in today's world, it is artificial intelligence, it's cybersecurity, it's the electromagnetic spectrum, mobility. These are all areas where now more than ever, you know, the commercial space is both leading in some of the technology development and also investing the vast majority of the R&D resources, and then competing to scoop up the top talent. And I know you've seen this from your vantage point at the top of a major research university. And so those are just some of the areas of disruption. And then if you put on top of that, that we are trying to reinvent a hybrid or flexible work model, trying to figure out how to accomplish these missions in a way where we don't have everybody in the office all the time. You know, it makes for a pretty dynamic mix. So those are just a few of the things that we worry about.
What about generational change? You know, with Gen Alpha is on the planet. They'll be in the workforce pretty soon. And we'll have four or five, or in rare cases, perhaps even six generations all working for the same organizations at the same time. That must be creating havoc with the way things work.
Well, just to give you the range here, we welcomed a class of high school interns, think folks that are 15 or 16 years old. I just celebrated the 55th anniversary of one of our senior engineers at MITRE, who started in the workforce here in 1968. So yes, we do have that full range. I'll just observe that there is always a lot of talk about what makes these generations different. A lot of my emphasis is what are the things that make us the same? And we in particular are trying to attract folks who really believe in the mission, whether it is creating a true deterrent national security capability or reinventing law enforcement or being able to crack, think criminal rings that deal in dark markets and drug smuggling, or be able to figure out how to take cost out of healthcare and improve care at the same time. I mean, those are the kinds of missions that really get all of those generations excited. And then I think, a lot of my focus then is what are the common things that we need to do to enable that particular workforce, given the span of generations. And what I have observed is certainly in the latest generation coming in, this interest in mission and purpose is even stronger than maybe we've seen in recent years. And so to me, that's a pretty good sign that we're in a good place for our organization. But I'll just give you an honest example. You know, we are struggling as we think about serving a broad range of folks. You know, what? Just take the development of human resources plans and benefit plans. We know that we need to be inclusive. We know that we need to be able to serve a broad audience. And what we've found is that now you have to be able to have almost tailorable kinds of solutions, again, within the cost constraints that any business faces. And so taking a different view towards, I don't want to say a menu-driven approach, but recognizing that you have to start in any of these kinds of discussions with a recognition that you're going to have a wide range of people in a wide range of phases of their life coming shaped by different experiences. I grew up in the Cold War. The Cold War was long over when our current group of interns came in. In fact, you know, things like 9/11 and the Twin Towers were long in the rearview mirror when they were even born. So when I talk about some of the things that I worry about, these are hypothetical and historical kinds of events, not real present day events that they've experienced. And so designing your management approaches, designing your systems, designing your business model, all of this needs to start now with how am I going to get the best and keep that purpose and mission-driven interest from a very diverse set of employees. And it, of course, is generational, but it is certainly, we have, and this is an amazing thing, when I think back over my career, many, many more women in the engineering workforce and the leadership workforce, which is great. We have greater racial and ethnic diversity. And so as a leader, your starting point today has to be, how do I ensure that there is an environment of belonging, back to that word environment, an environment of belonging.
I get the strong feeling that I could sit and chat with you for another 2 hours, another 3 hours, and I'm sure many of our listeners around the world have a similar sense. Before I hand to Russell to close, can I just say a very, very personal thank you for your openness, your honesty, your candor that came through, the candor of a good leader. And I particularly recognize that in today's podcast. So from me to you, Keoki Jackson, my great thanks and appreciation.
Well, thank you, Daryl.
And Keoki, I'm gonna close this out in a slightly longer way than usual. I'm going to give you the chance to have the last word. And this is from left field. I know that you're a skier. I notice that you've written about what skiing has taught you about life and work. What has skiing taught you about leadership?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, first of all, thank you for mentioning that. I think it's the LinkedIn post that's generated the most interest of anything I've ever put out there. Let me mention 2 points. First is you have to embrace the requisites of leadership. And if you are, and I talk about this in terms of teaching my kids to ski, right? Sometimes somebody has to be in charge, but you have to think about that in a way that enables those people who are still growing in their careers to be successful. So that embracing those requisites of leadership and understanding that that you do need to take the lead is really important. And then the other thing that I'd leave you with is it is a team sport. And yeah, I always think back to these signs that I used to see skiing in New Hampshire when I started skiing as a kid from Hawaii. And they said something along the lines of, don't ski alone. These mountains are going to be as cold and lonely tonight as they were 200 years ago. And, you know, thinking to your questions about working up and down and working across, leadership is a team sport. Embrace that, live it every day.
Yogi Jackson, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast.
Well, thank you, and best wishes to all my friends in Australia and around the world.